People have gotten vaccines all their lives, balk at taking the vaccines available for COVID-19, and make claims like the vaccine makes me magnetic. Is that rational? Votes counted again and again show Joe Biden winning the presidency over Donald Trump by a lot, but Trump and supporters speak of a stolen election. Is that rational? We'll focus less on the individual stories and more on the overall concepts as we visit with Steven Pinker to talk about his book, Rationality, what it is, why it seems scarce, why it matters. Steven Pinker is a psychology professor at Harvard University. His research tends to focus on language, cognition, and social relations. Dr. Pinker is also a prolific writer with many short pieces out there, along with 11 previous books and 4 more he has edited. Steven Pinker, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
So the second sentence of your preface kind of gets right to the heart, the matter at hand. This is an era blessed with unprecedented resources for reasoning, but we're not using them terribly well, are we?
That's right. We have the means to address our biggest challenges, most obviously a raging pandemic, and less obviously climate change. But there's a widespread resistance, confusion, a proliferation of pseudoscience, quackery, woo-woo, conspiracy theories. That's one of the great paradoxes of our era, is how a species that in some ways is clearly rational, we really are Homo sapiens, on the other hand, why is there so much flapdoodle?
You know, and it is weird because we have access to so many facts and figures and so many sources of information. Now, we can go to primary sources in a lot of cases on the web, and yet we tend to go for the secondary ones where the people have already attached their emotions to them.
Well, indeed, and few of us can access the understand all the primary sources that are relevant to some issue, like what to do if you have COVID, how to prevent yourself from getting COVID, what's the most economically viable way of meeting climate change. There are thousands of articles in the literature. Many are behind a paywall. Many of them are too technical for a layperson to follow. So we do rely on experts, people who synthesize that literature and make recommendations. And a big problem is, whom do you trust? Do you, the people in the white coats, are they just another priesthood that you can take or leave? Or have they commanded the trust of large parts of the population? Because, you know, to be honest, I'm a scientist, I'm a professor, but, you know, I can't follow all the atmospheric chemistry behind the claims of anthropogenic climate change, but I do trust it because I know how they work, I know what's behind it, I know that I could probe if I had to. I trust them, but lots of people don't.
You get to the theory that that we are just not evolved enough yet, that we are basically a caveman society out of time. You reject that, though. Why?
Well, our hunter-gatherer cousins, and presumably our hunter-gatherer ancestors, are highly cerebral. They survive by inference. In particular, they interpret faint tracks in sand and dirt as a sign of what species left the tracks, what its condition was, where it's likely to go, whether it can be chased down. They devise intricate tools and traps and poisons. They wouldn't survive if they had to just rely on instinct. They figure this all out themselves. They share it with language. And that's what it means to be human. So when you see irrationality around us now, I say don't blame the hunter-gatherers. they're plenty cerebral. We've got to look at features of our own society to see why we reject what we have amazingly accomplished over the last few hundred years.
Well, then instead of looking backward, there is a school of thought that goes to look to where we are now and where we're trying to get, the idea that we are getting closer to true justice and equality, and getting to that point makes things messy and upsets a lot of people. What do you think about that part of it?
Well, indeed. And another one of the irrationalities of our era is that many people are convinced that racism is getting worse, that it's worse than ever, whereas any way you measure it, it's less than it ever has been. It's if you look at opinion polls of whether people approve of, say, interracial marriage, whether they'd move out if a African-American moved in next door, whether they think that racial minorities don't work hard enough or aren't as smart, aren't as lazy. All those opinions, which were quite common in the 50s and 60s, have plunged to near zero. If you look at more subtle measures of implicit bias, like those devised by my colleagues Mazarin Banaji and Tessa Charlesworth, the implicit association test that tries to measure unconscious bias, that unconscious prejudice has gone down over the last 25 years. If you just look at behavior, do people actually marry people from different races? It has zoomed upward. So you look at Google searches for racist jokes, they're less popular than they ever have been. So by many measures, we have been making progress. But because of vivid anecdotes that are that we get through the news media, someone tells a racist joke, there's a bit of racist graffiti, we don't mentally tabulate how many instances there are now compared to how many there used to be. And so people can be unaware of these trends.
All right, so progress being made, but the example you just gave about which comes to John Gruden, who just resigned as the coach of the Las Vegas Raiders in the NFL. This is a guy who's been working around black people his entire working life in his industry, and yet he still managed to come up with some horrible things to say about them. I mean, yet you think that we're still on the right path?
Well, you just committed the fallacy yourself. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there were fewer of those episodes 30 years ago?
No.
So you answered your own question. I have found, having written two books documenting progress quantitatively, in terms of graphs that plot something bad, like war, like homicide, like violence against women, like child abuse, and when you do that, you see that the curves more or less go downward, all of them. They're not in a straight line. There are wiggles, there are backtracks, but they do go down, and I found that people say, well, that can't be true. Look, there's still people who beat their kids. Well, yes, there are, but that's not the point. There's a difference between saying something has disappeared and saying that it has declined. And it's funny that I have found over and over again that people somehow just flout that law, that principle of arithmetic. To say that something is less than it used to be is not the same as to say it's zero. And, of course, ideally, these things would be zero, and it would be good if we could push them down to
okay,
zero.
Okay, we need to pause there. Other side of a break, rationality, what it is, why it seems scarce, why it matters, back on the exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Dr. Steven Pinker, a psychology professor at Harvard University, who researches language, cognition, and social relations. He's a prolific author. His latest book is called Rationality: What It Is, Why It Seems Scarce, and Why It Matters. We'll explore the general concepts, and we're getting some specific examples dealt with right now. You can join the conversation on the exchange by phone at 800-838-3760. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to give you a chance to finish the thought, because we were talking about the fact that yes, for example, people do still beat their children, but at lower rates. So there is progress there, you're saying.
Indeed. And the progress is masked by a feature of human psychology, one of the most famous of our cognitive biases, sometimes called the availability bias. Namely, we base our sense of probability and risk on how easily we can recall examples from memory, available examples. So we kind of use our memory, our brain search engine, as a way of doing probability. So if we read about a plane crash, then we don't get on a plane. We don't read about car crashes. They're just too boring to report on the news, but they kill vastly more people. And so we make foolish choices about our safety based on gory incidents that we can recall instead of the best data on actual risk.
All right, so reason is mentioned many times from the start of the book. Are reason and rationality the same thing?
More or less. They come from the same Latin root, and many dictionaries will define reason in terms of rationality and rationality in terms of reason. One could differentiate between reason, meaning the correct answer to problems, the benchmarks for how we ought to think, and reasoning, which is what we mortal humans actually do. Especially when we do it consciously, we call it reasoning. And ideally, we reason according to the laws of reason.
Now, do you hold some space between irrationality and stupidity?
I do, because there have been tests of rationality separate from tests of intelligence, of raw brain power. That is, do you fall for various statistical and logical fallacies? If I ask you, what are the chances of being in an accident in a year? And then later in the questionnaire, I say, what are the chances that you'll be in an accident within the next 3 years? Well, the second one's got to be greater than the first one. You know, a lot of people just don't think it through and they get the same answer. So that's an example of irrationality. Now, you can put together a bunch of quiz with a bunch of items like that, and you see, do people who fail to fall for these fallacies, do they tend to do well on IQ tests? And on average, yes, but there are lots, not perfectly. So there are plenty of smart people who commit fallacies. There are people who are not as smart who spot them. So rationality depends not only on raw brain power, on, you know, say, if I give you some list of digits, can you repeat them backwards? But also on habits of mind, being open to new evidence, calibrating your beliefs according to how strong the evidence is, being willing to change your mind, being reflective, thinking twice, not going for the first answer a snap judgment or a gut feeling, but pausing to think it through. All of those go into rationality, and they are not the same thing as intelligence.
Well, in fact, there is a whole series of little quizzes in the book and things like the cognitive reflection test, which is three quick questions, and I flunked. So what do they show us about how our brains work?
Yes, and I'll give credit to Shane Frederick, who devised the world's shortest rationality test, or at least it's a test of cognitive impulsiveness. Do you just go for the first answer that pops into mind, or do you step back and think what actually is the answer? And they're not like, you know, tough math problems. They're actually quite simple. So I'll just give you the first one. A bat and a ball cost $1.10. The bat costs $1 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? People say, oh, 10 cents. Okay, wait a sec. Stop and think. If the bat costs a dollar and the ball costs 10 cents, then the bat costs 90 cents more than the ball, not a dollar more. The answer is 5 cents. So you $1.05 plus $5 equals $1.10, and $1.05 is $1 more than $5. Well, once you hear that, you slap your forehead and you think,
right.
Oh, of course. You know, this is not, you know, advanced math. The problem is that people get distracted by superficial features of the problem. You know, $1.10 is $1.10, $1 more, and the words, the loose words, just make an answer pop into mind. And it's only when you stop and think that you get the right answer. So there's a couple of questions like that. If there's a race and the person in you overtake the person in second place, what place are you in? And a lot of people say first place. Well, think about that.
Right.
If you overtake the person who's in second place, you're still in second place. Again, there's an impulse to give an answer that is associated with the words in the question, but not the content when you actually think and break it down.
Steven Pinker's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is Rationality, What It Is, Why It Seems Scarce, Why It Matters. So there's some things that we can clean up in our thinking and how we approach problems. You take us through confirmation bias and other examples, and it makes me wonder if it's not so much rationality that lacks in some of us as just humility.
Indeed, and arrogance and overconfidence are big enemies of rationality, some of the biggest, because there are plenty of people who are you know, are smart enough to come to the right conclusions, but they hate to be told they're wrong, and so they won't think twice. Or when evidence changes and it turns out that one of their beliefs is false, they dig in. They show how principled they are, how stubborn. How they can't be pushed around, and they cling to a belief that's wrong because they used to hold it. Some people even consider it a virtue, stand by your principles, as opposed to the famous quote, sometimes attributed to the great economist John Maynard Keynes. He didn't actually say it, but that he gets credit for it. When the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do, sir? So those are some of the things that can make us more rational, but that, as you say, involve a certain degree of humility. It gets even worse when it's not just you being Mr. Know-it-all, but your side, your team, your political party, your coalition, your sect being right. There, people like to be fearless warriors for their cause. For the left wing, for the right wing, and they often will refuse to back down from some position if it makes their entire team look foolish.
So basically, being incorrect no longer matters in that context.
Indeed, there's a perverse kind of rationality to it. Rationality is always in pursuit of a goal. It's not just saying true things, but it's saying useful things that get you what you want. And one of the things you may want is to be accepted by your social clique, to be a good warrior, proponent, hero of your cause. If you're a Democrat, to be the one that advances the cause of the Democratic Party, or vice versa. Sometimes called the my side bias. My side's always right. And if your goal is to be valued within your own side, and to avoid being shamed, ostracized, condemned, then it's kind of rational to believe false things if those false things are believed by everyone in your coalition. So from the narrow goal of social acceptance, it might make sense to have some belief. From the broader goal, and of course the goal that we all want to promote, namely believing true things, from that point of view, it's irrational.
So it gets more pronounced then when it's more important to be accepted by the group than it is to be correct.
Absolutely. And that accounts for some of the craziness of our current era. There are social circles where if you say that Biden won fair and square, you'll be a pariah. You'll be a traitor. You'll be a heretic. And so there's a strange rationality to saying that the election was stolen because it makes you popular. If that's your goal, then it's a rational way to be popular if you happen to live in a Republican enclave.
Our guest is Steven Pinker on the Jefferson Exchange, a psychology professor at Harvard University. His latest book is Rationality, What It Is, Why It Seems Scarce, Why It Matters. This is a conversation you're more than welcome to join on the Exchange. By phone, it's 800-838-3760, or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Mark in Merlin. Thanks for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me on. Mr. Pink, you are one of my two favorite authors in the world. Shakespeare is the other one, but you are the second one.
That's great. Thank you.
So, actually, I spent a lot of time in New England from where you live in the vicinity. I was wondering if you are familiar with a book that was published by a lady named Ellen Peters. It's called Innumeracy in the Wild, and it has to do with numbers and how we misinterpret numbers and all those things. And the other thing I wanted to ask you was, do you think that there is any sort of prospect for those of us who try to be rational in the world? Is there any sort of prospect that we can have an input into people who are irrationally? Saying that they don't want to get vaccinized, do the thing. Anyway, so
All right. Thanks for that, yes. Mark. Very much appreciate that.
Sure, yes. I am familiar with Ellen Peters' book, A New Mercy in the Wild. I've read it, and she is an Oregonian. I believe she teaches the campus in Eugene. It's an excellent book, highly recommended. And what she shows is that she gives amusing examples of new mercy, such as that when A&W hamburger chain came out with what they thought was a great product to beat the McDonald's quarter pounder. It's the third pounder, one-third pounder. It was a flop in the marketplace because people thought they were getting less meat because three is less than four. So she gives that as an example of a kind of new mercy. But she also cites data that people who are less numerate, where numerate is a fairly recent coinage analogous to literate, that is, do you have kind of a basic feel for numbers? Not are you an advanced mathematician, but just do you have a feel for quantities and simple calculations? She finds that people who are less facile with numbers have worse health outcomes. They can't figure out what medication to take. They have worse employment outcomes. So it really matters in your life. It's not just a question of doing well on school tests. You really live more successful lives if you can think in numbers. So, yes, highly recommended. What do you do with the anti-vaxxers? And this is blatant irrationality. Vaccines are the smartest thing our species has ever done. They have saved literally hundreds of millions of lives. They could save many more. They could get our economy back on track, put an end to our misery of the last year and a half. There are some people when there is a sacred belief for their tribe that they may go to their grave believing it. So you may not be able to convince everyone, but certainly showing the data that this actually saves lives and that the risks are tiny in comparison, that everyone accepts some risks in life. It's not as if anything is 100% safe. We get into cars, we walk along the sidewalk. And just open your eyes and see, you know, how many people do you know how many kids do you know who are in iron lungs because they have polio? Well, none, but that used to be a common sight, and that's because vaccines got rid of polio. How many people do you know that have smallpox? Zero. What about all the diseases that I had as a kid, like measles and mumps and chickenpox and rubella? I had all four because vaccines had not yet been invented. No, kids don't get that anymore, unless they have parents who refuse to inoculate them. So in addition to the statistical evidence, there's the evidence you get by opening your eyes, and there's just the course of human history where these horrible diseases just no longer are on our radar. Now, of course, these are rational arguments, and we know that if they were that amenable to rationality, they probably wouldn't be resisting in the first place. So one could also note heroes of their coalition, which is largely the political right, not exclusively, that Donald Trump got vaccinated, Mitch McConnell got vaccinated, a lot of people that they otherwise respect got vaccinated. Indeed, Trump takes credit for it. He thinks it should be called the Trump vaccine. I almost attempted to let him have it. Let's call it the Trump vaccine, and all of the Trump supporters will take it instead of coughing and infecting other people.
Shout out to Ellen Peters, who we mentioned in this conversation. She's the director of the Center for Science Communication Research at the University of Oregon, has been our guest on the program a couple of times now. So nice to hear her mentioned by
terrific
Mark
book,
and Murray.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. And Derek and Talent is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steven Pinker, the author of Rationality.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. And I think Dr. Pinker's comment on who to trust seems like a critical point. And so I guess I wonder how history and media, in particular social media, influence what you will call rationality. And for history, I guess I might reference Bush v. Gore on the election front, since we mentioned the election. And then like the Tuskegee syphilis crimes perpetuated by our government. And then for media, I guess I would use an example of Russiagate and false flag chemical attacks in Syria. And even the ivermectin recently, I found myself laughing at people about ivermectin, not realizing that the World Health Organization considers that on their list of essential medicines. So how does that play in, the history that we know and seemingly really wild things that might seem like a conspiracy at the time, and then we can look back at.
Okay, we lost Derek's phone call. It got a little mushy there, but I think you got the gist of it there, Steven Pinker.
Yeah, we have to. Well, the responsibility goes two ways. On the part of people trying to figure out whom to trust, we have to realize that scientists aren't prophets. They're not oracles. They're not seers. It's not as if God has given them answers, that they're kind of channeling from heaven. Our natural state about everything is ignorance. We know nothing about anything to begin with, and we got to do research to find out. And we're going to get some things wrong, because the way that science works is by trying out ideas, testing them against reality, letting reality falsify the false ones. And it is inevitable that some ideas that you come up with aren't going to be right first time around. That's just how science works. There are going to be errors. Plus, scientists are, and government officials and bureaucrats and are you know, human beings. They're men and women like us, and some of them will screw up. That doesn't mean that you can listen instead to the guy at the end of the bar who's spouting off, or some random social media post, or random supermarket tabloid, that it's all the same. Scientists make a mistake, therefore the guy at the end of the bar is just as reliable. Well, no. Scientists do make mistakes, but on the whole, we've eliminated polio and smallpox and gotten to the moon and lengthened life and developed varieties of crops that mean that there are no more famines in this country, and on and on and on. So you've got to look at the track record of the whole enterprise. Also, how do scientists come up with their conclusions? It isn't just someone's got a strong opinion and they shout over their opponents. They can show their work. They've actually done the research. They've gathered the data. Sometimes there are flaws in studies that can only be exposed by criticism, but still, it's better than just some neighborhood blowhard or some random site on the internet by far. Now, it also means that there's a responsibility on scientists, public health officials, government, public servants, and bureaucrats to continually earn that trust by showing their work when they have to, explaining the basis for their results, admitting their own fallibility. If you say, well, we made a mistake, it doesn't mean that they should never be trusted.
Okay, pause here again, please, Dr. Pinker. We'll come back and pick it up on the other side of a break. Rationality with Dr. Steven Pinker, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest is Steven Pinker, a psychology professor at Harvard University. His latest book is Rationality: What It Is, Why It Seems Scarce, Why It Matters. And we're getting a bit of an education in the ways in which we do think rationally and the ways in which we don't as well. You can join us on the exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And let me give you a chance to finish the thought. We had gotten a little beyond the taking the word of the guy at the end of the bar.
Yes. I was saying that we have to realize what science consists of. It's people. It's human beings. It's we start off in a state of ignorance. We don't know anything about anything, including scientists. And the only way that we make progress is we try out hypotheses and we see if the world falsifies them. And that means that sometimes we'll be wrong. That doesn't mean that the whole scientific enterprise is suspect. That's what science is. It's not a bunch of priests in white coats. And there will be mistakes. It's still better to if you can't do the library research yourself to trust the scientists and public health officials, then they blow hard at the end of the bar or some site that you stumble upon on the internet or in social media. But there is also the responsibility of scientists and government officials to keep earning that trust, showing their work, showing how they arrive at their conclusions, what trade-offs have to be made, not being identified with one or the other political factions. If science identifies itself as a left-wing organization, it's going to turn off people on the right. And I think scientists have been a little oblivious to the fact that when they brand themselves as a part of the general left-wing faction in the country, they are going to turn off large parts of the population. Even though they, I think they are guilty of that, nonetheless, the research done by scientists is much better than the various quacks and crackpots that might just have a website or have told a friend or your friend about something.
You know, and I think we tend to get into a place where we think that new information completely cancels out the old information. And the example is Derek was talking about the World Health Organization identifying ivermectin as one of its essential medicines. It does, in fact, identify it as one of its essential medicines for parasites, for anti-worming treatments. And that was in 2015. It was in March of this year that the WHO said we don't recommend it for COVID-19 except in clinical trials. So there's one more example of ways in which there's information that seems to contradict earlier stuff, but you got to roll with some of that. Let's go with a phone call here from Aaron in Arcata. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steven Pinker.
Okay, hi. Thank you for doing this. I'm going to load three vectors and hope that you speak to the middle of it. So it's not a question. I just want to get you started down a certain road. So number one, we are what we call in the age of super wicked problems. These are problems that must be solved, that are unprecedented, and that we don't have any historical background in how to solve them, so we have to innovate. Second point, it's not the way to bet exponential multiple vectors. People for millions of years have been in these bodies and 100,000 years with these brains, but exponential change is not something we're used to, and certainly not on multiple vectors that are critical and must be dealt with now. And so the thing you were talking about earlier about the in-group and the acceptance of the in-group, and as we've been socially engineered to be dumbed down so that we fit into working for an oligopic economy, the going with the herd, which has always been the way to bet, now becomes a critical error and a narrowing of our processing of our salience landscape. So the last point is this: parasitic processing, based on the fact of the differential between what the herd has grown to be competent at, which is linear change, versus the world we actually live in, which is made up of multiple exponential vectors that are multiplying each other in ways that nobody has the imagination for. And so just going with your instinctual, I'll hang out with the herd and go where the herd is going, is you go from there.
Okay, thanks for that, Aaron. So basically, Stephen, are human beings being asked to leap into zones that they're just not used to occupying?
Indeed. That's why we have organized scientific communities that can be collectively smarter than any of us is individually. So yeah, there's just no way we can wrap our minds around some of the problems that we face. And exponential growth is a perfect example, because that's how an epidemic spreads. That is, every time someone gets infected, they no longer not only get sick, but they themselves become an infector, and they turn other people into infectors. And so the number of people who contracted COVID in its early stages zoomed up exponentially, catching a lot of people by surprise. At the time, it was, well, it's no worse than the flu, it's no worse than strep throat. And at the time, it wasn't, if you actually count the number of people who had it. But it was contagious enough that it did increase exponentially. And our intuitions tend to have a lot of trouble with exponential growth. Another one of the problems in the cognitive reflection test that we talked about earlier in the conversation is you've got a pond, it's got a patch of lily pads, the patch doubles every day. At the end of 30 days, the pond is completely covered. On what day is it half covered? And people say, oh, day 15, maybe day 16. And the answer is day 29. Because if it doubles every day, then when it's the day before that it's completely filled, that's the day that it's half filled. So that's an exponential process. But again, it confounds our intuitions. Now, not all problems are exponential. They are, I do agree, they're wicked, but climate change is not an exponential problem, but it is certainly a wicked problem. And I think it's true that our intuitions can't keep up with the magnitudes of climate change. People think that, well, if I avoid plastic straws, I'll be doing my part to avoid climate change. Well, it's just not going to add up. When you have 32 billion tons of CO2 emitted into the atmosphere every year, and you have to bring it down to zero, plastic straws aren't going to do it. And there are other examples where, indeed, as the caller noted, our intuitions are not commensurate with the magnitude of the problem. But that's why we have science. That's why we have computer models. That's why we have math. That's why we have equations, so that we can tame these problems. We can't make them completely intuitive, but we can use these tools to ramp up our rationality.
Let me take another phone call here from somebody we haven't heard from before, Nate in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steven Pinker, the author of Rationality.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. I admire Dr. Pinker's work. I haven't read the book, and I certainly will. The simple point I wanted to raise in terms of terminology is about 300 years ago in the 1820s or in the 1720s or 30s, Jonathan Swift, the great ironist, defined humans as capable of rationality, not necessarily rational or irrational, but capax rationis. And that seems to me a good base definition to start. And I appreciate the big issue of this era at time is how do we deal with true believers and so forth. But are you familiar with the Swift in this term? I don't know where it is. As you get older, of course, we forget. I don't know.
Thank you for that. I was not familiar with it, but I think that it hits it on the money. We are capable of rationality, and often we're rational in some zones, but not in others. In fact, I think that's true of virtually all of us. Because even the people who have wacky beliefs about crystal healing power, or the stolen election, or QAnon anti-vax paranoia, they get dressed, they get to work on time, they hold a job, they got a checking account, they pay the rent, they get the kids clothed and fed, they keep food in the fridge, so you can't say that they're irrational across the board. They don't apply, at least they don't apply rationality toward the goal of our best attempt at the truth. In zones like the political identity, the causes that exercise them as they read the news, there the goal is to be entertaining, to rally people to the cause, to show how evil and stupid the opposite side is. Those are all goals that, and again, in a perverse sense, we can be pretty rational at pursuing those goals while being not so rational at the goal of affecting the best policies.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So you can take irrational actions in service of a rational process, or you can take irrational processes in search of a rational proposition?
I would put it the other way around. You can you can be rational in pursuit of an irrational goal, yes.
Wow. We have an email here from Jeff in Ashland who wants to go back to our discussion about bigotry and racism. He says, while polling may show bigotry and racism decreasing, is it not true that the actual statistics of things such as incarcerated people of color versus whites for the same crimes and the quality of drinking water in minority communities, et cetera, bear out different realities? And that from Jeff in Ashland.
Well, yes. And there were, it's unquestionable that there's that racism still exists and that there are racial inequities that may or may not be due to current racism, but maybe historical legacies. But the question is, what were they like 50 years ago? Were they any better 50 years ago? Has it gotten worse? And the answer in pretty much every case is no. Now, there was an incarceration boom for all races after the great American crime bubble from the 60s to the 90s, and many of the incarcerated people are still were caught up in that unfortunate development in American history. So it did get worse when first crime exploded, and then when there were attempts to deal with crime, some of them went overboard. So that's a case in which incarceration went worse, and it disproportionately affected African Americans. At the same time, because crime has gone way down since the 90s, except for sadly last year when it shot back up again.
Murders.
But yeah. It also means that since African Americans are also the victims of crimes, when the crime rate goes down, that saves thousands of African American lives every year.
So some of the examples of thinking exercises in the book are quite provocative. And in this realm, I mean, like asking at a dinner party, if you were racist, who you'd be racist against, which is, a tricky exercise, which nobody recommends. Does thinking no. outside the rational, though, help to identify what is rational?
Yeah, it's that's an example of a taboo that we all share. No one wants to play that game of, just hypothetically, just saying, in theory, we know that no one's a racist, but if you were a racist, what group would you be bigoted against? It's a game you really don't want to play. There can be a kind of rationality to not letting your mind go in certain directions. But ultimately, it's rationality. The thing about rationality is that it can always step back and look at itself. And so when anyone says, well, why is rationality so great? Look at all these people who said they were being rational and did stupid or horrible things. And that happens. But it is because we are now applying our rationality to those cases that we can identify those practices as deplorable or foolish. So you can't get out of the rationality game, but you can always apply rationality to attempts to be rational. And that's the ultimate power of rationality.
We've gotten down to our final minute here, and I guess the final question then would be about ultimately, do we use the mislogic in other realms, like Red Sox fans saying Yankees suck even when the Yankees win the World Series? I mean, has that now spread to many more things other than just sports?
Oh, yes. Oh, boy, and I say that as a Red Sox fan. Indeed. In fact, I think you have put your finger on probably the biggest source of public irrationality. That is, why do people resist vaccines? It's because the libs are in favor of it, and libs suck. Yankees suck and libs suck, and vice versa. Because people on the left are also victims of the my side bias, and they will reject things if conservatives are in favor of it. It's a bad habit that we should all get out of. Sometimes the left will be right, sometimes the right will be right. It doesn't matter who's right more often, just no one's infallible.
All right. Dr. Steven Pinker, a professor of psychology at Harvard University, researches language, cognition, and social relations, written many books. His latest is called Rationality: What It Is, Why It Seems Scarce, Why It Matters. Thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thanks for having me.